Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
What we can say at the moment is that it's a calculated move by the police and the ruling party CCM, trying to hold us back, not to go every place where we have planned to go for the campaigns of our local leaders.
Tanzania's main opposition says the use of state institutions to intimidate and harass opponents of the administration should stop.
So I think we're looking at a new chapter, definitely a new style in Somaliland's politics. And as we've heard from some foreign capitals, a lot of Western governments have also congratulated Somaliland on the elections. I think this has helped to raise Somaliland's profile and to improve its prospects for international engagement.
Somaliland elects a new president. We'll have an analysis on expectations and regional impact of the vote.
The allegations that the NDC peddled or is advancing, which they told Ghanaians at their press conference, lacks any merit, has no basis. They have not brought forth any evidence.
And Ghana's ruling party denies plans to rig the coming December 7 general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Tanzania, the Director of Protocol, Communications and Foreign Affairs of the main opposition, Chadema, says the arrest of the party's leader and members is a move to thwart the group's campaign efforts ahead of the coming local elections. John Mrema says the opposition party remains committed to the respect for the rule of law and justice for all Tanzanians. This after Chadema demanded the release of the party chairman Freeman Mbowe and other leaders who were arrested by the police ahead of a planned campaign meeting to rally support from the party ahead of the polls. John Mrema tells me that state institutions, including the police, should not be used to intimidate and harass opponents of the administration.
The chairman of the party, Honorable Freeman Mbowe, with his local leaders, accompanied by the chairman of the Nyasa zone, Joseph Mbilinyi, they have been arrested by the police while they were on their way to a campaign rally in a place called Vwawa. The campaigns are only for 7 days, and as you know, this country is very huge. So arresting him is a way of trying to sabotage our campaigns, because they have blocked him not to go to Tunduma, where he was supposed to hold a big rally in Tunduma in the Songwe region. So by arresting him, what we can say at the moment is that it's a calculated move by the police and the ruling party CCM, trying to hold us back, not to go every place where we have planned to go for the campaigns of our local leaders.
What are your lawyers saying about this arrest?
Our lawyers are still talking to police, demanding where he is. And as you know, he was arrested upcountry. Songwe is in a border with Zambia. So it's far away from Dar es Salaam, it's far away from party headquarters. And we are trying to get some lawyers from Mbeya, the Songwe region, which is about 100 kilometers by driving, so that they can assist.
But the question some people are asking is, did Mr. Mbowe, the chairman, and for that matter, Chadema, get all the permission needed? Because sometimes the police say that you don't follow due process to enable you to hold rallies. You go there and then complain when the law is enforced.
We are in campaigns. During the campaigns, we don't need any permission from the police. We do send campaign timetable to the local officials in those particular areas. Nothing else we are supposed to have. So there is nothing like we have to follow any due process. What is needed is only an information to the local leaders that will be holding our rally tomorrow in place A or place B. That's all during the campaigns.
Mr. Mrema, critics of Chadema are accusing the ruling party of colluding with the police to stop your campaigning is not true, because the CCM has dominated and they are going to win this election hands down. So they don't understand why you are accusing them, and that this is just a publicity stunt by Chadema just to make the ruling party unpopular.
It is not a publicity stunt. It is the ruling party's directives to the police that they should not allow us to move smoothly. The first day the Freeman boy has started the campaign, and the first day has been arrested. So how do they say that they didn't ask the police to do that? What I can tell you for sure, if we have breached any law, they are supposed to send us to the court of law. But we'll find out at the end of the day that nobody will be sent to the court of law, because they have nothing to go and tell the court. Why have they arrested our party leaders?
Will Chadema and other opposition groups engage the ruling party or the Electoral Commission to resolve this concern that you have?
The big problem we have is that this election is not supervised by the Electoral Commission. It is supervised by the president's office under the local government authorities, where the president is the minister responsible for the local government authorities. And so the Electoral Commission is not involved at all. So we have nobody to engage rather than the president. And the president is from the ruling party, and right now she wants to win and show the world that she is and her party are still popular. So we don't know if she will engage with us or not. But what we demand is that we need the police to immediately release the chairman of the party with his entrance, so that they can continue with the planned campaign rally.
John Mrema is the Director of Protocol, Communications and Foreign Affairs of the opposition party Chadema. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Somaliland, newly elected President Abdi Rahman Mohamed Abdullahi is calling for unity following his victory in this week's presidential contest. This, as his supporters celebrated across the country after he defeated incumbent President Musa Bihi Abdi. According to the Electoral Commission, Abdi Rahman Abdullahi garnered 64% of the total vote cast, while Abdi's Kolmiye party came in second with 34%. Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991, but has yet to receive international recognition. A recent memorandum of understanding with Ethiopia aimed to help Somaliland gain recognition angered the Mogadishu government. For analysis of the elections and the expectations of the new administration, I reach Matthew Bryden. He is the co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank.
Well, it was an extraordinary and in some ways an unexpected victory. Not unexpected in the sense that he didn't have a chance of winning, but that he won with a much larger margin than expected. And I think this signals, first and foremost, a shift in Somaliland's internal politics. It's the first time since elections started that we have a government elected with such a margin. So he has a mandate to govern. His opponent, the incumbent president, Musa Bihi, has conceded victory and promised that he will facilitate a peaceful and smooth transition. And so for Somaliland, I think it's a very positive development, and the results are more promising than most had hoped for.
Well, what are your expectations of the new president with this new mandate that he's gotten from the people?
Somaliland politics has been very much based on personalities and constituency politics rather than platforms. So what we know for sure about President-elect Iro's platform is only that his party is committed to the pursuit of Somaliland's recognition. It has placed a greater emphasis on reconciliation with opposition groups in the east and to a lesser extent in the west of the territory than his predecessor. And that he's committed to friendly or constructive relations with Somaliland's neighbors, which had chilled under President Bihi in large part because of the memorandum of understanding signed between Somaliland and Ethiopia in January this year.
Talking about the memorandum of understanding, both of them are united in spite of their differences on the recognition of Somaliland by the international community. But do you think his approach is the best way to go?
Well, the MOU with Ethiopia, I think, is widely popular in Somaliland because it offers the first step towards international recognition. And it would be very difficult for the new government to step away from that. On the other hand, what we hear from President-elect Iro's entourage is that they haven't actually seen the document. And so they have been careful to say that until they have seen it, reviewed it, and probably spoken with Addis Ababa about it, they're not prepared to make firm commitments on how they would proceed. But there is no doubt about Iro or his party's commitment to Somaliland's independence and pursuit of recognition. Critics have suggested that he would resume dialogue with Somalia and that somehow he favors Somali unity. But that is a deeply unpopular proposition in Somaliland, and it would be extraordinary, counterproductive, possibly political suicide if Iro's party were to move in that direction. But there's no indication that that is what he intends to do.
So you think that the mandate he's gotten could embolden him to pretty much seek more international engagement and recognition for Somaliland's independence and to be recognized as a sovereign nation rather than a breakaway region from Somalia?
I do. And I think what the president-elect has done and his party has done is underscore that they are ready for dialogue with Somaliland's neighbors, with Somalia and Djibouti, not to pursue the MOU with Ethiopia to the exclusion of relations with the others. And that's an eminently reasonable position. To be fair, the most strident opposition to the MOU has come from Mogadishu, which has declared it non-negotiable and requires it to be rescinded. What Iro is proposing is that relations can be subject to dialogue, which is, of course, the way states should conduct their relations. So I think we're looking at a new chapter, definitely a new style in Somaliland's politics. And as we've heard from some foreign capitals, a lot of Western governments have also congratulated Somaliland on the elections. I think this has helped to raise Somaliland's profile and to improve its prospects for international engagement.
Matthew Bryden is the co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Kenya, anti-tax Gen Z protesters have welcomed the decision by the Catholic Church to reject cash donations and pledges by President William Ruto and his administration. This after the church rejected a donation of $40,000 from the president aimed to help build a house for a priest and also as a gift to the choir during Mass last Sunday at the Soweto Catholic Church in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Robert Mwangi, a Gen Z protester, says the move shows the Catholic Church wants the government to be aware of the economic challenges facing many Kenyans. He tells me that it appears pressure from the country's youth has energized the church to distance itself from the government.
For us, it was a huge win because Kenya is a very spiritual nation and they believe a lot in what men of God say. So this one was a huge win because the moment men of God point out and say, return the money, since we tend to assume that it was a bribe anyway, they return it back. It was a very huge win.
So did Gen Z consider the gesture, the financial gesture made by the president, as a bribe?
Of course it was. Remember, it has come days after the Catholic Church made a statement about the state of nation and really criticized Ruto's regime and asking them what they've done, where they have failed in the health sector, in the education sector. Basically, they are paralyzing everything in this country. So the moment the church came out and said that it's not okay, and I think that's when the president decided to give them those money so that maybe they can change the tune.
Is this the stance of the Gen Z or young anti-tax protesters that the religious groups are too close to the government, and that is why religious groups have been too quiet in spite of what they see as things not going too well?
Yes, of course. You can credit the Gen Z. Remember, during the Gen Z protest, we never saw the church coming out and calling out the government really as we expected them to. And most of them came way later. But at least now this initiative has now come from the church. And it's a good thing that even now the elder people are getting on the bandwagon that was started by the Gen Z of criticizing the government and calling for better governance. And so I think right now the point that we've gotten, it's because of the power that Gen Z have been putting and the pressure they've been putting to the government.
How did you react when you heard the Catholic Church pretty much criticizing the administration over its handling of governance in Kenya?
It was a really huge, because remember, the Catholic Church has one of the deep roots when it comes to religion. Most of these leaders go to the Catholic Church. So the moment that they are calling out leaders and telling them that they are not doing well, it's a very, very huge thing. And remember, in Kenya, people really listen to religion. They listen to these religious leaders.
So let me ask you this, because supporters of the government are calling on religious leaders not to interfere with governance. Your take on that?
I think the politicians have just been being politicians, and they are the same people who on Sundays go to those churches and try to make statements, use the church platform for politics. So right now, when the church, they're involved in church in politics, but they don't want the church to be involved in politics. But I tend to believe that this is a matter of the whole nation, not only the church. It's a good thing that people are coming together and saying we need a better governance.
Robert Mwangi is a Kenyan Gen Z protester. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Uganda, the defense lawyer for opposition figure Dr. Chisa Besigye is welcoming calls for charges against him to be dropped. Aaron Kiza also says the family of Besigye and other human rights defenders plan to sue the Ugandan government for what he says were the violations of the rights of the opposition leader. His remarks come after the Uganda Human Rights Commission denounced the charges against Besigye and co-accused Obaed Lutale Komolegyia while urging the government to drop the case against him. Appearing in a military court, the two accused were charged with illegal possession of firearms in Kenya, Greece and Switzerland. Both have denied the charges. Attorney Aaron Kiza tells me that the military court lacks jurisdiction to try the case in a military setting.
Yeah, we agree that the charges should be dropped because they are in the wrong court, in a brought by prosecutors that are not envisioned in the Constitution, but primarily because on four times the Constitutional Court has rightly held trial of civilians in military tribunal as completely unconstitutional, null and void, and any trials there are in violation of our national constitution, of international law, and of the court decisions from the Constitutional Court on several occasions. The reason is simple, that the military courts are not independent, they are not part of the judiciary, and they cannot provide people who appear before them, especially civilians, with the minimum due process and fair trial guarantees, such as the presumption of innocence, such as respecting their personal liberty, their right to counsel of their choice, and their right to be judged by competent people trained in law and who are not controlled by or commanded by other soldiers. All these concepts of rule of law, of administration of justice, are alien to the military, whose duty is merely to enforce military discipline. People who have not signed up to being military should not be tried in military courts, period.
The argument by the Uganda Human Rights Commission is that since the alleged offenses occurred on foreign soil, that is in Kenya, the case falls outside even the jurisdiction of Uganda's military court.
Yeah, that's the case. That is also the case. The government of the Ugandan authorities, even ordinary courts have no jurisdiction because criminal jurisdiction here is not extraterritorial. The the charges they have slapped on him are charges that must happen in Uganda. The proper courts to try him if you committed offenses are Kenyan courts. I think they overlooked that. But even if the courts had jurisdiction, trying civilians in military courts is illegal.
People are saying seeking foreign aid to come and destabilize the Uganda, particularly...
A few weeks ago, 36 FDC members were abducted in Kenya. And right now, Dr. Besigye is also abducted. Also, Turkish nationals were abducted.
I understand that the family of Dr. Besigye and his co-accused are going to take legal action for what many Ugandans are saying are the abduction of the former main opposition leader?
Yes, that is the case. The family will take legal action, but also concerned Ugandans are going to take action because this violation of rule of law cannot go unchallenged.
There are suggestions that opposition leaders in Uganda are saying Kenya is no longer safe for them as opposition leaders. As a human rights activist, is that the stance you also take?
Kenya is safe for no one, whether you're opposition or not. There is another person called Samuel Kanye who was involved allegedly in Kenyan Gen Z protests. He's an artist in Uganda. He's still in prison. So whether you are a politician or not, opposition or not, you're a foreigner, you're in trouble. But of course, even opposition politicians are in deep, deep trouble because if you dare go to Kenya, you are likely to be abducted. It is becoming more dangerous to be in Kenya than even in your home country. I've already warned Kakwenza not to step in Kenya, and I'm advising my other clients to leave Kenya out of their schedule if they think that they are on government radar.
Aaron Kiza is the defense lawyer for opposition figure Dr. Chisa Besigye. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The communications director of the Ghanaian ruling New Patriotic Party, or NPP, has dismissed accusations that it plans to rig the coming December 7 general election. Richard Ahiagba says the allegations are a clear attempt by the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, to reduce popular support for the party in the run-up to the presidential, legislative and local elections. His comments came after the NDC held a press conference to denounce alleged plans by the governing NPP to rig the elections. But Richard Ahiagba tells me that the allegations are a publicity stunt to garner sympathy votes for the opposition in the coming polls.
The allegations that the NDC peddled or is advancing, which they told Ghanaians at their press conference, lacks any merit, has no basis. They have not brought forth any evidence whatsoever to support that allegation. Rather, they're just conjuring this out of thin air. They are just looking at incidents or that have happened in our past and individuals who have done their work in service of this country and suspecting them to be elements or agents of NPP's campaign activity. That's so true. We have no other plot to win the election besides canvassing hard, which we have done, and up and down this country, people will testify to you that for the first time in the history of our country, a certain presidential candidate has visited every constituency, literally every constituency, not one left behind, and is going back in his track to touch on a few constituencies. That has never happened, and that is not a candidate who has an ulterior motive or has a secondary plan to win the election. His only plan, the NPP's only plan to win the election, is to win the confidence of our people.
But Richie, some Ghanaians are saying that rather than dismiss it outright and say that these are mere wild allegations, there has to be perhaps an investigation to determine whether it is true or not, because that could potentially cause some uncertainty and tension to rise in the run-up to the election. What are your thoughts?
No, fine. I mean, the investigation is not ours to do. What we know to be the truth is what we have come out to communicate clearly, to say that those allegations don't have any basis. They are not happening. The New Patriotic Party is not engaged in any such thing. If there is anything to investigate, it will not be from us, but the police service may have to do that, or the security service may have to do that. And that is independent of the New Patriotic Party in our campaign.
What do you say to those who are saying that the NPP has colluded with security agencies, with the Electoral Commission, and trying to silence the opposition using all the influence or the trappings of incumbency and the power it accrues to ensure that you win the election? And in spite of the issues they've brought up, none of them, they said, have been addressed, with the sole aim of maintaining power and maintaining power only. How do you respond to that?
Well, but you know, the truth of the matter is people just have to pay attention. If you're listening to political conversation and the allegations that are raised by the opposition, you are likely to fall victim of this mindset. But what you ought to listen to is what is happening. And if at any time the NDC raises any concern about any of the electoral processes, how does it end? Look, they said that during the voter exhibition process, they said that, some number of voters have been transferred illegally, right? They made a public cry about this, press conference statements, and the rest of them. So for the first time in the history of IPAC was televised live for all of us Ghanaians and international to be able to see. And at that forum, the NDC did not bring one singular evidence to validate that wild claim they made. And that session closed with all Ghanaians watching live to see that the NDC actually lied to the country that something untoward was done by the EC in collusion with the New Patriotic Party. It's never happened.
Richard Ahiagba is the communications director of the Ghanaian ruling New Patriotic Party, or NPP. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Nigeria, an ECOWAS court has awarded more than $17,000 to Glory Okoli as reparations for human rights abuses by the Nigerian police. This after the court agreed with her petition following allegations that she was tortured and enslaved by the officers of the Police Intelligence Response Team of Nigeria in 2021. Attorney Samuel Ihezekian, the lawyer for Okoli, says the 21-year-old was detained for over 90 days, which he says was a violation of the Constitution. Local media reports say the police had accused Okoli of being a member of the government-designated terrorist group IPOB, or IPOB, or Indigenous People of Biafra. She was then detained and allegedly forced to cook and work as a maid for several weeks while in police custody. Okoli was later released on March 23, 2022, after spending 248 days in detention. For more reaction on the ECOWAS court ruling, I reach attorney Samuel Ihezekian.
This is a matter that commenced sometime in 2021. And she was kept already for more than 60 days. And the reaction of the police then was that she's being held down on allegations of espionage and other related offense, that she's housing money for the rogue organization known as IPOB. We did not believe in any of these allegations by the Nigerian government and the Nigerian police. So what we did was that we filed a case at the FCT High Court, also filed at the ECOWAS Court too. We secured an interim bail for her at the FCT High Court. Then the federal government did not obey it. The police did not obey it. What happened subsequently is that she was charged before the federal high court. We went before that court, we contested the charges against the federal government, and we also applied for a bail. So the court, looking at the merits of the matter and not really seeing something so sustainable, the court agreed with us and discharged and quashed the charge. We went again to the FCT High Court. The FCT High Court agreed with us that she was tortured, She was deprived of a lot of things. She was used as a maid to cook in the Nigerian police force prisons and all that. And several allegations that were made against the police. And the court, the local court here, awarded her $60 million.
How will you collect all these sums of money for your client?
We must get it. This is a judgment of the court. And by virtue of the ECOWAS Treaty, the rules and everything, Nigeria is a party to the ECOWAS Treaty. And the ECOWAS, the rules that create the ECOWAS Protocol. And they must comply to the Nigerian to the ECOWAS judgment.
Where do you and your clients go from here in view of the ruling by the ECOWAS court and by local courts in Nigeria?
The impression we are having is Nigeria is a judgment compliant country. They comply and they obey judgment. So the problem is they have it in their hands. Do they comply with the local judgment from our local courts and the international judgment from the ECOWAS courts in the $30 million to be paid by the Nigerian government? Alongside some a little cost to be assessed by the ECOWAS court. And we have the $60 million judgment from the local court that is standing on the credit of the GEDA has not been complied with. So the question is, we engage the Attorney General of the Federation, who is the chief law officer of the government and representing every issues, to see how we can reach probably a settlement, a negotiated settlement of this judgment sum against the Nigerian government on this matter. That is our intention. And we believe with the new administration and the Attorney General, who has said this present government, they respect rule of law, they will be judgment compliant. We believe either of this judgment or the entirety of these two judgments will be obeyed by the Nigerian government. They will do everything. It's when all our options fail, then we might need to start looking at further legal action to attach the properties of Nigerian government to make sure that this judgment is compliant with. Or we register the international judgment as a judgment of our local court here and also proceed against the federal government accordingly. But I know, if I take some little time, the judgment will be complied with.
What does this ruling really mean for your client?
The ruling is actually being celebrated from far, near, and wide. One of the issues there is that we must always understand that it's actually an illusion for anyone to think that our courts are not working, whether international or local courts. Present your facts and your case and do your best. And also, too, we also must understand that for every breach of every human rights entrenched and recognized by the Constitution of Nigeria, every breach of it, there is actually a punitive measure. The punitive measure can be in a way of damages or costs. It must come with some consequences. So the advice, the state of Nigeria, the agents of the government, the Nigerian police force, they must understand that they need to operate in line with the best international practices when it comes to government and policing. And when they are in breach of it, they will incur consequences like this the ECOWAS court has just done today.
Samuel Ehiasekan is a Nigerian lawyer. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Malawi's first female flight crew, Captain Yolanda Kaunda and First Officer Losekelo Mwenifumbu, are working to inspire the next generation of aviators. The pair have organized air shows with the Malawi Air Force to give children opportunities to see aircraft up close. Their most recent event, held Saturday, attracted around 1,000 underprivileged children. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
It might seem just like another sunny day at the airbase in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, but for hundreds of children gathered here, the day is filled with excitement. For many, this is their first time seeing an airplane up close and entering the cockpit. For some, this may be their first step toward a career in aviation. 15-year-old Cindy Steamer is a student at Kuala Girls Secondary School.
It has been my dream to become a pilot, and I really, really am excited to learn more.
For 7-year-old Roba Fadzo Nakove,
I want to be a pilot engineer when I grow up.
Malawi's first all-female flight crew, Captain Yolanda Kaunda, and First Officer Losekelo Mwenifumbo, work for Malawi Airlines. The Jewish Phantom Aviation Association organized the show in partnership with the Malawi Air Force. when Ifumbo says the aim is to showcase airplanes for children in rural Malawi who sometimes seek refuge when airplanes fly overhead due to a lack of familiarity.
We got about almost 1,000 underprivileged children to come in to just give them a pinch of an imagination, just to spice up their imagination. And because we believe that imagination is what is going to make them more curious for knowledge. So we believe in the children, we believe in the dreams, because we also believe in our dreams in the first place. So we want to encourage as many dreams as possible, and we're not stopping here.
The theme of the show was Dreams Take Flight, and it rekindled the excitement of aviation, even for other attendees like Rosaline Hamis.
It's also my first time to come to a place like this, and I've been inspired. And if I had a chance to have, you know, been exposed to this type of lifestyle before, I would have chosen to become a pilot. So it's so nice for me too.
The show's organizers allowed visitors to step inside helicopters, jets, and training aircraft. Puma Energy Malawi was the main sponsor, providing fuel for all the airplanes, which performed skilled and daring maneuvers. Tourism authorities say Malawi's aviation industry is not appealing to young people, in part because of its small size. Uvera Kantukule is the Minister of Tourism in Malawi.
Well, we don't have a lot of airlines coming into Malawi. We don't have a lot of airlines, even domestically, moving within the country and all of that. And then the issue of infrastructure, where we have, you know, our airports. We have been talking about Nzuzu Airport. We've been talking about Chileka Airport.
However, Kantukule says the Malawi government is working on policies that would attract greater private sector investment in the aviation industry. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Lilongwe.
Artificial intelligence was much discussed and demonstrated at the Africa Tech Festival in Cape Town, South Africa, earlier this month. The conference highlighted how technology is changing industries on the continent. For VOA, Vicky Stark filed this report.
Big names like Meta, Microsoft, and the United States government were on a keynote panel at this year's Africa Tech Festival in Cape Town. The topic was the transformative potential of artificial intelligence. Here's Ravi Bhatt of Microsoft Africa.
In the 15th century, when printing press was invented, did we know what was going to happen to the world after printing press? When electricity came in the 19th century, did we know at that point in time where is the world going to go? AI is that general purpose technology. These technologies come every 150 years, and when they come, they change the world forever.
With AI already being used in everything from social media algorithms to medical diagnosis, Bart said it would continue to make people's jobs easier.
Job augmentation is what the world awaits. New jobs will come. Your jobs will change. You will learn new skills.
Joy Basu of the U.S. State Department appealed to tech leaders to not leave behind Africa, which needs education and infrastructure investment. Basu said she was proud of the U.S. government's Digital Transformation with Africa program and the work Washington did to ensure a resolution on AI safety was passed at the United Nations earlier this year.
I've been so delighted in the way the U.S. has tried to really lead a consensus at the U.N. For safe, secure, and trustworthy AI development. There were 22 African co-sponsors, there were 123 countries that joined on, because I think as a world we know that this is an incredibly powerful technology.
To demonstrate the good AI can do, the U.S. government, in partnership with IBM Consulting and the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, announced an AI medicine tracking system for Africa. Here's Josh Berlin from the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy.
Counterfeit, substandard, falsified medications are even more of a problem here on the African continent. So being able to equip pharmacists and other members of the supply chain with tools to trace medication helps provide additional visibility into the supply chain, but also has the knock-on effect of protecting patients.
Describing herself as being very green when it comes to AI, Sikim Suseni, the owner of a South African public relations firm, said she used ChatGPT in her business, but the festival had opened her eyes to the many other ways the technology can be used.
Considering the unemployment rate of South Africa, very high, especially in the youth unemployment rate, I personally feel that AI will equip young South Africans to apply for jobs and also be able to get more upskilling through using AI platforms.
A recent report from tech giant Google says AI could add $30 billion to the economy of sub-Saharan Africa by 2030. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
It's time for Music from African Collection. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer the great Tiang Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, surrounding yourself with dwarfs does not make you a giant. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Je ne viens pas, la presse de la Marawi.